The Reserve Pool, Episode 8, Spin Cycle. Hello, folks. Welcome back to another episode of The Reserve Pool, a podcast about Dice Masters and, more importantly, the people who love to play it. As always, I'm Dave.
I'm Katie.
And I'm Evan.
And that's all of us. Before we get into the meat of the show here, we want to do the typical social media spiel. So first, please give us a follow on Twitter, at The Reserve Pool. Please drop us a line, or an email at least, at mailbag@thereservepool.com. We may use what you have to say on the show, and we got some of those coming up later today. You'll certainly find us around BoardGameGeek and Reddit. We have a BoardGameGeek Guild, which you can find on our website. We also ask that you click that little heart by our name on BoardGameLinks. You might see us around BoardGameGeek again. You'll see us around Reddit and all that stuff. But give us a look. And of course, don't forget our website at www.thereservepool.com. And before we move off of that, I also want to give a quick thanks for a couple of more 5-star reviews on iTunes. We have both ServoDeath and Firebird. Thank you so much, guys.
Thanks a bunch, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, just the fact that we fooled people out there into thinking that we have anything of value to say, just it does warm my heart a little bit. I don't think I'm any kind of gaming expert or anything like that. I don't know. I don't attempt to sound like that. I don't want it to come off that way.
We just pretend to know math.
Yeah.
we try, but, there's definitely a little bit of shock that you guys are just loving us so much, and we want to keep making great content for you guys.
Yeah, and we want to keep it humble, too, so please keep us honest, folks. All right. Well, again, thank you so much, everybody, for the support. This has just been phenomenal. So moving on, though, we give a lot of discussion to the games that we play, whether they're Dice Masters or not and stuff like that. But let's shift the focus a little bit to one of the places where we buy our games. You know, we might talk a lot about, oh, I pre-ordered Uncanny from Cool Stuff Inc. and it only cost this much and whatever else. But you know what, guys? Those friendly local gaming stores are so important because without them, for one, where are you going to play organized play stuff? WizKids is dealing with the stores, not with individuals. We need these places around. We got to do everything to support them. That's where we're going to help the community grow and everything else. So let's give a little bit of love to the game stores, which we find to be the most friendly. What do you guys think? Where do you guys love to go?
The one that always sticks in my mind as just my favorite store has got to be Phantom of the Attic. It's in Pittsburgh. It was one of my mainstays when I was in college, and I dropped a lot of cash with those guys. let's be real. Dice, cards, board games, especially also role play system, books as well. And they were super awesome there. And they had some great, everything from apples to apples to Call of Cthulhu. So maybe I should have picked something that ended, had a Z in it, but I try, but they're really great, and they were really close to campus, so they're the ones who stick in my heart when it comes to like my favorite store, and I try to visit them every time I'm up in Pittsburgh for whatever reason.
Yeah, being a Pittsburgher as well, that's a good choice. That's definitely a good store, Phantom. They have a couple other locations too. I don't know if they're related or not, but the one in Oakland, I think, is what you're talking about, and it's great group of people there. How about you, Evan?
Well, aside from my own fond memories of Phantom, I have my fond memories of in New York City. There used to be a place called Neutral Ground, but they're long gone. They were a really nice place to meet and play games of all stripe. Nowadays, I find myself going to Boardwalk Games over in Port Jefferson, and they're really, really friendly there. It's unfortunate they couldn't get the OP going this time around, as they haven't really gotten enough starters to feel like they can justify doing so, but I'm hoping that for the second round, I've starting to hear reports of people getting more starters in, I'm hoping that they'll be able to run the second round.
Yeah, we're certainly due for some more starters, that's for sure, all around. I think that third printing should be finally making its way around soon.
Yeah.
Gosh, I hope so.
Oh, I think it's that third printing that will hopefully finally push us into like the equilibrium point where it can be a little less crazy than it is right now.
Yeah, where if somebody wants to just go and buy Dice Masters, they can do it without having to like make it a strategic tactical operation with like military plans and stuff.
We're like push big on maps. Facebook for, you know, can someone get me a starter for, you know, weeks on end.
Seriously. I mean, well, and I understand it. If I didn't have one, I would be one of those people. So I understand that totally. My favorite gaming store is, it's actually also in the Pittsburgh area, as that is where I am from. It's funny, we all have ties to Pittsburgh, but I've never met you guys in person. But it is called Mr. Nice Guy Games, and that is out in Monroeville, just a little ways east of Pittsburgh. This place is phenomenal. What used to be a small shop over in a community called Oakmont is now built into an entire, I think it was an office depot in the out parcel near the Monroeville Mall. This is the biggest game store that I've ever been in. I tell you without a doubt in my mind that this place could handle two Friday Night Magic sized events at the same time and still have room for other people to game. I don't know a lot of game stores that can say that. The staff is friendly and helpful. The owner is a super, super cool dude, incredibly nice and knowledgeable guy. I've met many people there, and in fact, you know, when I've talked about meeting people there to play Dice Masters like I did in the previous episode, that's where we've been going. Great store, great people. Unfortunately, Evan, it's the same deal as you're saying with the organized play. I think they have in total got four starter sets and two gravity feeds since the game was released. Luckily, one of those starter sets and one of those gravity feeds was mine.
Yeah. Congratulations on that, Dave.
It wasn't easy. I couldn't believe they didn't have it. Well, the trick really was that they got it a couple of days after release was when their shipment happened. So I was just kind of like, it was a right place, right time kind of thing. So
I reserved mine because I was fixed on the prize.
Well, and you know, I think it is so important to keep things in perspective with these stores. Again, we'll talk a lot about, I mean, full disclosure, I pre-ordered Uncanny on Cool Stuff Inc. As you said, Evan, it's got to be a sure thing. And I, especially with us covering this stuff, I want to make sure that I have a kit, you know, and not be waiting for it.
Yeah, well, it's know? Reached a point where it's no longer it would be nice to have it on release day. You know, we really need it now so that we can be bringing that news to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe we can move into some video stuff and do some unboxings, because who doesn't get tired of those? Judging by the content of YouTube, I think a lot of people don't get tired of those. And to be honest, I think they're kind of fun myself. It's neat to see what to expect if you don't have your stuff yet and live vicariously through what others have done a little. But it is important. And I try to make sure, like, some of my concentrated game buying, I spread that around. Sometimes it's online. The best thing about Mr. Nice Guy is that almost everything there is below MSRP. That is the best thing about them. Is it quite to like Amazon or Cool Stuff prices? No. But it's enough that I can get it immediately, and I'm not quite paying full price. The guy there, he has a good business sense. He knows that he's not just competing with the other brick and mortars. And that's the other thing that makes it great that I forgot to mention. He keeps that in mind, and that way... He ensures that he's going to have my business. He provides a great thing. He goes out of his way to do stuff. You can't beat it.
Obviously, you guys have been sending us a lot of really great encouragement, and I don't want to lie, these things really help all of us really love to continue to do this week to week. But you guys also have a lot of questions for us, and we love those too. Always send us some mailbag at thereservepool.com, and I am going to start off reading the first letter that we got. Ray writes, hello, Reserve Pool. Thank you for all you do and the fantastic show every week. Thank you. His question was, he wanted to reach out and ask about what we thought about having a distraction card as part of your force. And he doesn't mean distraction, the basic action. He's talking about a card as one of your eight cards that you think is viable and you could run a team around, but really it's a bit of a cheat and it's not the card that you really are going to be focusing on using. I assume that would be something like maybe a Cyclops if looks could kill. But he specifically mentions Mjolnir, making your opponent think that they shouldn't be able to field their villains. But at the end of the day, you really don't have any intention of actually buying a Mjolnir. So what do you guys think about the distraction card, the false card that you put in your deck to put your opponent off his or her game?
I would totally do this with Gobby. If I had a Gobby, I would totally just bring Gobby and everyone would go, oh God, it's Gobby, and play like they're going to fight a Gobby and have that inform their early purchases and then just not buy him at all.
But Evan, then you couldn't bring Nog.
I know, it would be very sad. But I've actually found recently, sometimes there are squads you don't actually want to bring Nog on. If you've got a lot of churn, he winds up stepping on his own feet too much.
Well, let me ask you this then, Evan, because when I thought of Gobby as maybe a card that wouldn't necessarily work. When people are using Gobby, they are using a pretty specific set of cards. In general, the Gobby squads are very slim variations on what's otherwise a very common theme. If your deck doesn't have those pieces, I'm either going to think, well, he's not using Gobby, or I might think, well, he has some crazy thing with Gobby that nobody's even seen yet. But if you don't buy Gobby early, are they going to think you're going to use him? And if you do buy him, are you setting yourself back? I guess that's my only question with using Gobby as something there, because I wrestled with that myself. What do you think?
Yeah, that's a pretty fair point. But I think, especially if you've really got your team in seven or something and you don't really need that extra card, and I guess to a degree the extra dice, just having the Gobbies there, you know, will make your opponent think twice for that first turn, and maybe it means they don't buy those Tsarinas, or, you know, maybe they don't buy something else they need, or, you know, yeah, maybe they're bringing Gobby and they don't want, they're a little worried about a Gobby duel. But yeah, no, I mean, there are probably better choices, but it's always fun to just be, you know, everyone seems to get really panicked about Gobby. And yeah, I think it's true. It's the tank shock.
Well, okay, yeah, that's fair. And I think you raise one great point. I want to add another to it. But yeah, you're right. If you have that, like, seven cards and you're trying to figure out what's number eight, well, throw in something that could be a good, as Ray puts it, distraction card. Especially, I think, if you're building a hybrid constructed and you're like, well, geez, I have one more slot to fill and I really don't know what to say about it. See if one of those cards could be used that way. This could also be good Loki bait. And things like that. But I think that he actually stumbles on another point here, and maybe even intentionally. I don't want to say stumble like he didn't know what he was doing, because I think Ray does. But he has a good suggestion here. What I think it ultimately boils down to is that if you can find a way to build a viable squad that has more than one way to win built into it, and then if you have a fallback, if, you know, say they see past this, and like I don't know, Punisher McRook was your distraction card and you have something else in there that's really your killer, and they don't fall for Punisher, well, you still have a very viable card there that you can use to win. So maybe the real lesson here is find ways to make something that could have multiple win conditions, so that if one way is shut down, perhaps by Loki or something like that, you have another means in there. I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good point, having multiple ways to go about your win. I think that's something that is sometimes hard to remember when you're sort of like, oh, I have a Gobby, let's go from that. Or, oh, I have a Tsarina, let's go from that. Just a situation where you do want to be open-minded and know, you know, if this fails, that can go forward. I was actually thinking that Professor X, Charles Francis Xavier, is a really great Loki bait card. Because that's one of those cards where you're like, oh, they're going to be looking to do some denial on me. They're going to try to keep me from being able to bring my cards onto the field. They maybe even pop Loki on him. And unlike Gobby, you have an excuse for not buying him early because he's expensive. So they're sitting there going, uh-oh, you know, that's going to come out. That's going to be what they're pushing for. That's going to be that card that they're going to really focus on getting a die, that they're really going to look on focusing to get the energy to buy. But then you're like, nah, that's totally not what this is about. Especially since Professor X works well with Storm. And I just like to bring Storm. So unlike a Gobby deck where you're missing a lot of the support, I mean, because Storm and Professor X, they go together like peanut butter and jelly. And they just make this really great combination. So nobody's going to look twice if you've got a Storm and a Charles Francis Xavier. Of course, I'd probably Loki your Storm. But yeah. but this is beyond, this is beside the point. I think higher cost cards are the ones that are more viable as a distraction card because you have that excuse for not jumping on it right away.
That's a great point. What do we have next?
Question. Actually, a few questions from Dusty. The first of his question is that he has a question about actions. He's asking when an action clears from your reserve. For example, if you can Power Bolt or Vibranium Shield during your opponent's turn. And if I'm remembering the rules right, nope, they're gone at the end of the turn.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
And
yeah,
I honestly would prefer if that wasn't the case, because I think there's a lot of interesting things you could do with, you know, I could see people keeping Power Bolt in reserve. You know, it's like Lightning Bolt in Magic. Oh, you put out that Sarina. No, not this turn.
Yep. And Dusty, you can look on page 9 of the rule book in the cleanup section. It says, any actions still in a player's reserve pool are moved to the use pile. So no, you can't keep them for your opponent's turn. Like Evan said, I don't really like this. I think it's not cool. And honestly, it makes cards like Take Cover, which adds a lot of defense to your team, kind of useless, in my opinion, because I think invulnerability is better because it does much the same thing. Your characters won't be knocked out when they're on the attack. It's actually more reliable than beefing up your characters with some extra defense.
Well, that's true. I have 2 points I want to make about that. First is Vibranium Shield, to Dusty's credit, it is a little bit different in Dusty, just check out that card, but you place the die touching the target character and it doesn't go into the used pile, and then you can move that to the used pile at any time to prevent all damage to the character for the rest of the turn. That's rare Vibranium Shield caps protection.
Vibranium Shield.
That one's a little different.
It is a little different, but actions in general that don't have specific rules that allow them to stick around, they are gone. And as a reminder, if you don't put it on a character in your turn, it's going to go away.
And I want to say that I actually do like that rule, and here's why. Here's why. Imagine for a minute that you have saved Mjolnir for your opponent's turn, and they field a whole bunch of villains, and before they can do anything on their turn, you wipe all of their villains. Now they have a completely clear board. They don't have a chance to respond to their clear board before you get another turn and then destroy them.
Yeah,
I think it would make
awesome.
It way too... No, that's horribly swingy. And I think there are other things that it could do to just really make the game drag out. It would become a lot of... It would make every game like a Magic the Gathering deck full of counterspells, which I know you can't have because you can only have 4, but bear with me there.
You do make a good point on that. Sometimes I just, you know, really wish you could, because there are some cases where it's like, oh, why can't I just keep this Power Bolt and zap one thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a slightly different case because it's, I use this one thing and everything my opponent has goes away. But at the same time, if they saw you had Mjolnir, maybe they shouldn't have done that. Maybe they should have, you know. He's got
an extreme example.
I'm going to focus on buying lots of stuff this turn.
Yeah.
Because he's going to blow up everything if I put up all my guys.
Sure. I mean, it's an admittedly extreme example, but I think it's the clearest one to drive the point. But yeah, what else does Dusty have to say?
Okay. He also asks what my thoughts on a life gain deck are. Cards with... which one? There's a couple of beasts that I think let you gain life. Iron Man, I think it's Philanthropist? Or is it Billionaire?
Philanthropist.
Philanthropist. Captain America.
Wait, no, philanthropist shares damage.
Ah, ooh. So I think it's billionaire then.
I can find out.
Nope, I am wrong about being wrong. Philanthropist.
Okay, then. I mean, with the name, it makes sense that it would be philanthropist.
It does, but I was like, oh, philanthropist, he shares his damage.
There's a Captain America as well who lets you, it's the one who gains life for every sidekick your opponent has knocked out. The Bane of the Gabi.
Yep.
Personally, I think there's potential for life gain decks. I think right now there aren't enough solid options to really make something very life gain oriented. There are a few and you can sort of get there, but I think it's going to wind up being, I use life to, you know, I gain a couple of life here and there, and then I do some other thing to really win. As opposed to, I am an immovable wall, my HP goes to 16, and then it's back up to 20 at the end of the turn, and you will never, ever kill me. I don't quite think we have the presence left to do that yet. Maybe Mighty Thor will do that? Or at least help with that? But I have a funny feeling that come Uncanny X-Men, this is going to be a lot more valid. I can't say why, I don't actually know if there are any characters who will necessarily even involve life gain. But I'd like to think there would be.
Yeah. There's not enough tools in your belt for a life gain deck yet. Like you mentioned, Beast. And of course, I'm of the opinion that you need a really, really good reason to not be bringing 666. That's kind of where I fall on that line, is some of the cards that you're like, ooh, it'd be really cool if I could use that. It's blocked out because you'd rather be using a different version of that character.
I think that the cards that do exist, though, fall pretty well into a cost curve that you could make it work. The reason that I don't think it's viable is because in this game, you cannot have more than 20 life. Eventually, if you're focused a lot on life gain, your opponent's going to reach critical mass with what he has in his fielding zone, and he's going to get to the point, he or she is going to get to the point where they can just wipe you out 20 points in a turn, and you're not going to have the chance to respond to it. And I think that's really the biggest thing against life gain, is that we do have a ceiling that we cannot exceed, and inevitably, if you're gaining a lot of life, that means there's stuff that you're not doing to your opponent. They're going to get a lot of stuff out, and it's going to be bye-bye.
You need a really, really strong offense to go with the life gain. And really, life gain is an incredibly defensive strategy. So they're
turtle in this game, I don't think.
And if your opponent brought, you know, if looks could kill Cyclops, he'll just plow through all your guys and then send his dudes in, and that'd be it.
Yeah.
You know, that's one of several examples I can think of. But I do think there's potential for it, but not yet. Its time will come.
Not yet.
Or like a Human Torch Green Goliath thing. I mean, that's, you ping everybody 2-3 times, or even more. All of a sudden, you know, Hulk's got through like 6 damage, and that's it. So, but that's certainly a good question. I'd be curious to see if it happens, but I kind of like that the game has an offensive bent to it right now.
Yeah,
I hope it stays.
Yeah, I'm comfortable with it.
Yeah, not everyone agrees. I've definitely seen some people comment that it's sort of like a slightly slower game that lets us use the giant pool of enormous characters. But
yeah. I mean, there's arguments to be had both ways. You need to be playing quickly in the current meta.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially with organized play. I mean, 3 games in 45 minutes, that doesn't leave you a lot of time. And that's a limitation that people complain about in just about anything. That certain decks in Magic, I've heard people complain, aren't viable because of the time limit that they have in their organized play. And I think Android Netrunner suffers from this the worst, because that is a complex game, and some of the speed decks are the favorite, even though there are some amazing, amazing things you can do in that game. But I digress. we have a third one we're going to get to this week, and this is Pablo. This is Pablo from Chile, in fact. He has this thing eating his mind, and he wants us to resolve it. And I think we're going to be able to help you, Pablo. Loki Illusionist, he's referring to here, takes control of one opponent character, and then that character gets KO'd at the end of turn and inflicts his attack to your opponent's life. The thing he's worried about is what happens if he attacks with that stolen character and he's not blocked. He would go to the used area and can't get KO'd. Would he get KO'd from the used area? Would he stay in the used area without doing direct damage? We'll answer that in just a second. I want to finish this. He also says, thank you for the podcast and keep doing it. You are doing a great job. See you at thereservepool.com or Reddit. Thank you so much, Pablo. I want to say before we get to the answer, Katie, I know you know this one because we were talking about this. We're getting like this international flavor here. This is Chile. We've had people get in touch with us from Poland, from Sweden. We're seeing hits from all over the place here, and that just kind of blows my mind. So I just wanted to say, international listeners, thank you so much. And if there's anything we can do to kind of help make the show accessible for you, please let me know. I'll do what I can. I edit the show and put it together. If there's anything I can do, let us know. We'll do what we can. I don't know what that would be, but we'll try. And thank you so much. Anyway, go ahead, Katie. I know you you have this one.
Actually, I was reconferring with the rules, and Pablo, I wasn't quite clear on what your question was. And now that I've heard it, I'm actually not 100% sure. I think what you're going to find is you attack. Loki is not blocked. He goes through and damages your opponent, of course. And he goes to used during cleanup because the end of your turn is cleanup. Basically, it seems that you get one or the other. You know, you can either attack with it, you know, and have it get through, or it can either not be attacked with or be blocked. And then you would... Wow.
Katie, you don't need to sound so hesitant because I think you are right from our discussion before. I'm looking at page 21 here in the rule book, and that says when you take control of a die, it becomes yours for game purposes. So, Pablo, you can absolutely attack with it and so forth. So it goes to your field. You place it on top of the die controlling it. Your controlling die cannot attack, but the controlled die, so whoever you took from your opponent, can. But if the control die is... let me skip ahead to that, I'm sorry. Here we go. If the control die is sent to your prep area or used pile, it goes to your opponent's prep area instead. Otherwise, when your control of the die ends at the end of the turn or whatever else, return it to your opponent. So if it's going to go... If you're going to like find a way to get it off the board, your opponent, it looks like, actually gets it in their prep area. So I would wager that unless you have some killer move that you can make, it might be better... To let it hang out. Yeah, if it has a lot of health. No, if it's something like maybe you captured as a storm and you're going to use the ability and do something that way, it can be worth it. You're just going to have to measure the risk or reward because if it gets prepped or KO'd from your actions, it's going to go to your opponent's prep, it looks like.
Yeah, I don't think you get to double dip is really what we're looking at here. You can't send it to... what becomes your own used pile, but also then gets funneled into your opponent's prep area. I really don't think you can double dip and take advantage to hit your opponent and then hit your opponent again with the KO damage. So one or the other, not both.
I think that's about right. All right. Well, thank you so much, everybody, for writing. Sorry, Evan, there wasn't much to say. That was straight up from the rules and we kind of got it.
No, that's not a problem. I'd actually been thinking about that one before completely independently.
So there you go, Pablo. You are not alone. These are all great questions that you're sending us. We'd love to hear it. Please don't worry about sounding like a noob. We are happy to respond. If it doesn't make it to the show, there are some that I'm responding to as we get them here and there. We're discussing them with Katie and Evan. But we do already have some in the backlog. So keep sending them. Keep sending them. If we ever have trouble getting to yours, then we'll keep trying. But if you don't hear yours right away, it's because we got a queue already, guys. And we're going to get to them as fast as we can. Mailbag@thereservepool.com. So for our feature topic today, we wanted to talk about one of the more interesting, I think, mechanics in this game. And I think it's something that you only really get in a game that's relying on things like dice. And that is spinning. Spinning is the mechanism in this game where you can move a die up a level or down a level. And there are a lot of cards that use it. At my last count, it looks like about 14. Now, not all of those cards are particularly useful, But spinning is certainly in this game, and I think that now that it's been introduced as a mechanic here, we're going to see a lot about it. So we do have already that basic definition there of spinning just in the introduction. So it's rotating the die up or down a level. So this is, as I said, a bit of a newer mechanism and something more unique to a game like this. I'm not certain, actually, if Quarriors has it in there or not. So what was your first impression of this mechanism when you broke open the starter set?
I've got to tell you, actually, that spinning was the very first mechanic I tried out in a deck. I tried to build a whole spinning deck. Just I was focused on spinning characters down, and then I was using a Jade Giant and Creature Beast as kind of trying to finish off those low-level characters. Also, Smash is similarly good for this. But that was literally the very first thing I saw. It was really cool. You could bring your character's stats down to a lower level so that they would be less hard-hitting, easier to knock out. They'd deal less damage, they'd be easier to knock out, and just in general, it served you really well for that. So, I looked at all these cards and I said, spinning is awesome, I want to make a deck around them. So that was my first impression of spinning.
I think the thing that struck me once is, I think they always say, spin to the right, and no matter what I did, maybe I'm just being, completely obtuse, it happens frequently. They gave some, I think it was spin to the right or left to go up or down. And no matter what I did, I couldn't get it to go right. I'd say spin the die to the left. That's not the next phase. I couldn't get the hang of that. But, I actually like the mechanic a lot. And while, I may be sort of biased for this because one of the more powerful cards is very spin oriented. I do think there's a lot of potential to get up to shenanigans with it, and I'm hoping that they do so more so in the next set.
And quick tip, guys, when you're trying to spin your dice, the three character faces are adjacent to each other in a U shape, so you should never have to go completely and totally searching around your die. All three of them are right next to each other, so you should have an idea which way you're going just by looking at the die.
Which just confirms that I'm terrible at this.
Yeah, but they're oriented so weird. One, if you have one, level one right set up, then it looks like level two and three will be upside down and vice versa. And Evan, don't worry, I'm with you. I actually just noticed now that they were you just before Katie said it. And I have been like, wait, where is that?
Where's the next and side?
I realized they were adjacent. I can just never get to the right side. I think it is that they're not oriented. They're not oriented such that you go one, two, oh, it's right side up. Three, oh, it's right side up. And it's just... I see that, and my brain goes, just completely away.
They're oriented, I believe, 3-1-2 rather than 1-2-3, which is a little sad, but we will survive.
Yeah, and I would say that I didn't just open the starter set. I also kind of busted into the gravity feed very quickly after we played our intro game. And so spinning, I actually happened to be one of the lucky ones who got a Sarina in their gravity feed. And of course, as Evan alluded to, she's one of the more powerful cards in the game that spinning is definitely a factor with. So my first impression is spinning kind of centered around her and the card that we... the ability that she brings to the table, and which also made me realize that spinning as a mechanism is kind of cool because it isn't just for the cards that use it. Like Sarina is about spinning because other people are going to spin and respond. Your card doesn't have to have spin on it in order to use it, and I think that's kind of different compared to some of the mechanisms that we'll see in other collectible games. For example, an old one in Magic the Gathering was Cycle, where you could I don't remember what Cycle did, to be honest with you, so it's a bad example and I'm not going to use it. But one of the, for example, flying, where the creature has flying, it can't be blocked by creatures that don't have flying. That ability only impacts that one creature, and unless you're giving that creature an ability, it doesn't really impact them. But this mechanic This gives us a way for cards, every single die can be impacted by spinning. Some take more advantage of it than others, but that's not just about whether or not they have spin on their die. That's about like how Beast, we've talked about how his level one has the burst, and that is maybe his best face. Beast can use that like maybe better than some others because spinning him down is favorable versus somebody who maybe even has like, you know, spin this character up if XYZ happens, you know, printed as their ability text. And that was big for me too.
Yeah, those are both really good points. I think one of the things that makes Beast such an amazing die is that level one burst, because you spin him down and he has smaller stats, but he's much more powerful. All of his cards trigger an extra ability on that burst symbol, and it's just awesome.
Yeah, honestly, I think that the sort of predilection for things that spin things down maybe get you into the idea that, hey, you know, my character is getting weaker, but maybe that isn't a bad thing. Maybe it makes it easier for me to go and recycle them and do more stuff with them, and get into the whole idea of, you know, churning your dice your die pool so you can do more things with them.
I think that's a good point. And Katie, I think what you discovered with the spin deck too, like I did, is that you know, early in the game, it's easy to think about this in reference to other CCGs. We make the comparison all the time. And in Magic or others, you really want to get rid of the creatures that an opponent has out, because that's how you're going to get damage right to them. And so a spinning deck is like, wow, I can knock out all these things. And in this game, as we've discussed many a time, that can be a big advantage to the opponent. And all of a sudden, they're rolling like, you know, 50 million dice from because that's what you put in their prep area and everything else. So, you know, we've talked before, if you're going to clear the board and stuff's going to prep, you better be almost ready to finish the job right there.
You better be ready that
yeah,
turn.
Well, that's completely fair. But yeah, and I think looking at the spin deck like that, that also helped me learn something about this game, because I know that, Katie, you and I talked about that very early on. Coming from those types of games, it just really emphasizes how important it is to do that. So maybe that's tangential from spinning, but it's a lesson learned nonetheless.
Yeah, I was just really in love with it. Just the die and the spinning mechanic go so well together, and it's super cool, and I love that. Also,
it's really cool.
You know, she's not a spinner, but Storm, like a card that makes you re-roll the dice, it's just super cool too. I had to put that in as an aside to spinning and like things you can only do when your characters are dice.
Yeah, it's a very different means of manipulation than we see in other games.
Yeah, so I mean, my one big lesson learned from a spin deck is it kind of doesn't work. I mean, you can't have that be your only, trick in your bag, really. Not that it doesn't work at all or spinning is bad, but it can't be your sole means of winning. You know, it's not just about making your opponent's characters weaker or such. There needs to be some extra going on there, because I took Hawkeye. I didn't have Sarina at the time, so I took Killer Instinct, Black Widow's Rare, which is also very good, by the way, since you get to pick who spins down as opposed to Sarina, where your opponent picks. So I picked all of the spinning cards. I picked Hulk. And it just didn't all come together because, like you said, you clear the board, your opponent rolls 12 dice the next turn, and then you're in a really bad place.
Absolutely. All right, well, let's talk then about some of the specific. Let's first look at some of the cards that either force or at least entice you to spin. A few of those, for example, basic action card Focus Power lets you spin up one or down. It forces you because of the card, and that could be played either for you or against you. We have Force Spins with some of the Black Widows. We also have Encouraged Spin with the super rare Black Widow, the Sarina. Some of these different cards, Brer Hawkeye, spin characters damaged by Hawkeye to level 1. There are a lot of cards that force spinning in one way or another. The best used is certainly Sarina. Again, not forced there, but enticed. So if spinning is not the main mechanism, how can we force spins? How can we apply forced spins or enticed spins to work for us?
Well, I think one of the big things you have to remember. Well, I mean, you basically have to deal with that dichotomy of my opponent's dice will get smaller, and by making my opponent's dice smaller, they will die easier, and they will get all these dice to re-roll on their next turn. And the trick becomes, when can I best use this to my advantage? When can I make my opponent's swarm of guys who are now really small, you know, you can blow them off the table, you know, if you've gotten everything down to having, you know, one health or something, you know, now I play my Doctor Doom and they all die, and then my force just tromps on through or something.
Yeah, I suppose If Looks Could Kill is another nice one to take advantage of that, where you're hitting with a relatively beefy attack size when you move forward with If Looks Could Kill Cyclops. And yeah. So you're taking advantage of those low defense characters. But again, the big thing to remember is that's got to be your finishing move. You cannot wait for your opponent to have a turn where he or she gets to roll 10 or 12 dice. That is the turn that you could probably lose, because ideally what's happened is you've knocked out all of your opponent's characters, all your stuff you attack with goes through, and what happens? All your stuff goes to used, and yep. You don't have any defenders anymore.
Yeah, I mean, unless you're using Colossus, Russian Bear... but even so, he goes to the prep area rather yep. than use. So he's still not going to stay on the board. I do like that card. But yeah, I'm with you guys. I think it has to be used as one of the or in conjunction with some of the other board clearing strategies that that some like to use with this. Whether that's If Looks Could Kill Cyclops or a Green Goliath, Human Torch, Hulk, you know. It's going to take, if you can spin those guys down, especially some of the beefier guys, you're going to have just a little bit less defense, and you're going to have a better chance of actually clearing things out instead of leaving a few of the taller trees standing in the end. Beyond that, I also agree. I don't think it stands well on its own. Not at this point. There's certainly things that could be done. I'm sure some things we haven't even thought of at this point that can do this. We also have some useless, okay, I don't want to say useless, we also have some usefulness challenged cards that that encourage spinning one way or the other. Like, can we talk for a minute about for one, let's talk about the forced spinning. I don't really care that much for Venom Eddie Brock, the global ability, pay fist to spin an opponent's fist character down one level. I guess it's kind of interesting that his main ability, non-fist characters, can't block Venom. But what I really want to talk about here is Mr. Fantastic Elastic.
Yeah, I think we've talked about this before, I think about two podcasts ago when we were talking about the super rares. I think the big thing that Mr. Elastic suffers from, and I think the set of dice suffers from on the whole, is a lack of ways to spin dice back up. I mean, not complete lack. You obviously have focus power. But in general, there are not cards that are focused towards spinning things up. And I think that's something that we're missing in order to make the spinning mechanic more complicated, and not just a matter of spin everything down and it's small, or a character where when you spin it down, it becomes more powerful. You know, where it's level 3 has low stats and it's level 1 has high stats. You know, with fielding cost to match, of course, but I think that's the thing that's going to really shake it up. You know, shake up spin.
Yeah, and you know, actually, you bring that up, and when we've talked about how we quantify the fielding cost, we've said that, you know, if you reversed it for some reason, say, you know, instead of 1, 2, 3, it went 3, 2, 1 in ascending order of level, that wouldn't really matter when you're talking about fielding the die, because you're still paying, you know what I mean? A lot of things would still work. But if its beefiest face was for some reason the level 1, if there was a thematic reason that could work, when you're forced to spin down, now the die is getting more powerful. That would impact the level. And I that's actually something that I hadn't considered until right this moment, actually, as we're discussing this. If we did flip-flop how the levels were ordered, that would impact things. That would have higher stats on level 1 with a higher fielding cost to match, and then lower it as you go up. But then if you're spinning down, Well, there you go. That's just more punishment if your opponent's using something like Tsarina. More punishment than we already have when we're talking about taking advantage of the burst on Beast's level one face.
Yeah, I mean, so I think that's the big place, like, where I think it could go. But, sorry, I mean,
Looking at it, it looks like if they're showing the zero, they're showing the lowest faces of all the uncanny X-Men dice. What is most likely Ant-Man
he
does in fact seem to be a like low strength at his lowest face.
I was so sad because I really thought thematically, if there was going to be one die that got more powerful as it got smaller, it was going to be Ant-Man.
But nope. Opportunity is missed.
Sorry, guys. WizKids, missed opportunity there.
No, that's absolutely true. I mean, not just for Ant-Man, but thinking about ants and how they can carry X amount of their weight and whatever else. Yeah. Well, let's move on to a couple of those cards, though, that spin to your advantage, where you can control when and how they spin. Perhaps you get to spin up, and for example, I could say Colossus Unstoppable, 6 cost. At the end of your turn, spin each of your Colossi in the field up 1 level. We have a couple of cards like that. Certainly Focus Power allows you to spin your own up if you would like. What do we think about this? You know, like the Colossus, for example, I don't necessarily dig it because that means I have like 2 or 3 6 cost characters all in the field at once, and how on earth did I get to that point?
Yeah, I think that's also kind of a not super great one. What I want to see is something like Magneto Holocaust Survivor, which while Magneto is active, you may pay 2 energy to spin a villain up 1 level. I want to see a more generalized version of that uncommon version of Magneto, because I think that's where it's going to be interesting, is like, well, this character is fielded, you may, you know, spin up a character. We're really missing the spin up mechanic a lot, so
yes, especially to spin somebody up into their burst.
Yeah,
you know, like we really only have the one, you know, Tsarina has the consequence that we've spoken many, many times about, and I don't want to belabor it. But that's the one thing there. We don't have anything that lets us spin up to the burst to try and use our bursts strategically. There are a couple of them, like, again, Focus Power, we can spin up. But not a lot, not enough to make it really a viable strategy. And I'm with you. I'd love to see something where when fielded, you know, pay an energy and spin this character up, lose 1 life, pay 1 life and
yep,
spin a character up. Because that allows us to use our bursts strategically. And the burst mechanic and the spinning mechanic, I think, are very closely tied together in that way.
Yeah, although I will note that Hulk also has a low-level burst as true. Well. His 1 and 2 face are bursts. So also Wolverine, but he doesn't take advantage of it yet. We'll keep an eye out for that in Uncanny, though I have a feeling he's going to use his bursts in Uncanny.
So I'll note that if that's in fact what's going to be happening, looking at the Uncanny X-Men stuff, there's not a lot of bursts showing on it on what looks like the level 1 phases. It's
yeah,
Toad and
Red Hulk.
Hulk
is, of course, the same die as Green Hulk, so it's not surprising that his level 1 has a burst on it. But definitely not seen too many bursts, so maybe we'll see mostly high-level bursts or something like that. But definitely a question.
Which gives hope for that they'll
yeah.
actually
just
let
a little more than we have. We have some, but just I don't think enough.
Yeah, we definitely need more spin stuff up cards, because if we're spinning everything down all of the time, you know, that's what Tsarina is for. But I would like to see a more varied way to deal with the everybody's spinning my dice down problem.
And I think we will see it, and here's why. I base it really pretty much on WizKid's other big property, which is HeroClix, though certainly Star Trek Attack Wing is becoming a thing in its own right. But HeroClix, right? The whole purpose of that is to have this thing that when you move it, as they take damage, their abilities change, and they can change for the better or change for the worse. Hulk in HeroClix, for example, typically gets more powerful as he loses life and clicks down. So that would make you have to think more about the whole die, not just the face that the person fielded, but more about the whole die. And I think that's really cool and something that certainly wouldn't be out of bounds for this company, considering, again, their other big property.
Yeah, that would be very cool, knowing that your opponent would have a way to go up or down. So it's not just what was fielded, but the potential of that die if it were switched around a little bit.
Are the rules getting you down? Us too.
Today's Fact Talk is about Angel, specifically Avenging Angel. If Angel is blocked but not knocked out, he deals 2 damage to the opposing player. Angel is no longer sounds like a word. The question is, if someone uses Distractions Global on Avenging Angel, after he's been blocked, will he still do 2 damage? Personally, I do think that even, you know, if he was blocked and then left, the thing that was blocking him stays as blocking, so it only makes sense that he remains blocked. So even though he's, you know, winged off, he's flying, he's going, ha ha ha, I was blocked, I'll fire my angel beams at you.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree, because Evan and I actually had a similar question about Beast, where I had ended up not particularly good strategy because I wasn't thinking at the time, but I actually used Distraction to pull back one of my attacking characters that Evan had blocked with Beast, and so Evan still got to draw that die because Beast was still blocking even though the attacker had distracted off. So I think it's only fair that Angel, who's was attacking but distracted off, he continues to proc his ability of the when blocked but not KO'd. He fits all those criteria. He was blocked, he was not KO'd, and that fulfills the requirements of his card.
I think that's probably right. The only place where this could get sticky is if WizKids decides that the character actually has to still be in that state when things are dealt. Now, we have some things in the fact that seem to indicate that they don't. The only ones that seem to indicate that they would is if they were, knocked out and something happens, like, after damage was dealt or something like that, and they're no longer there to do it. Angel is still an active card. He was, in fact, blocked. It doesn't say that he has to remain blocked, or if he's blocking, or if he's engaged with a... if he's attacking and is engaged with a blocker, you know, none of those things are in there. So I think that's probably right. But
I do think that there is another card that we can use to prove the intent here. And it's actually Phoenix. And let me go grab her card real quick.
Do it.
Because that is the card that will prove that there's got to be 2 different intents here. And that is the rare version of Phoenix, Genie. And at the end of an attack step, each character still engaged with Phoenix deals damage equal to its attack to your opponent. So the thing is, the way that Genie is worded is that it has to be at the end of the attack step, and the character needs to still be engaged. And so that's the thing. Genie, she has a lot of attack, so it's highly likely that she will knock out anything that she's actually engaged with, in which case those characters don't deal damage to your opponent. So I think that's the thing. Genie, when she attacks and she engages, her ability only triggers if everyone is still engaged, where Avenging Angel doesn't make any mention of, it would say if Angel is blocked and not knocked out, or, you know, if an Angel is engaged, I don't know the exact wording of what would go there, but if Angel, at the end of the attack step, if Angel is engaged with a blocker, then he did.
Yeah, if he's still engaged, he wasn't knocked out. Yeah, you're on the right track there, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, so that's the thing, is this card could be worded in a way that would explicitly make the distraction not work. Angel distraction. Avenging Angel distraction. Distraction. Angel.
I think you guys are right there. I see When I've seen this discussed, I haven't thought that the other side had an argument that particularly convinced me, but I do still see where they're coming from, because it's not necessarily the most intuitive thing in the world.
Yeah.
So while I'm not sure that the arguments are necessarily the best, I also don't think that this is intuitive.
Yeah.
Based on the rules, it seems to make sense. But I think that's where we see some of the issues take place here.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these questions, a lot of these arguments, we usually fall one way or the other, or have a way that intuitively or logically seems to make more sense, or sometimes a lot more sense. But at the end of the day, there's still that question that lingers in enough minds that we have to ask the question. And, you know, maybe at the end of the day, there's a lot of these rules where if the ruling came down from on high, and they said, no, if Angel is blocked and distracted, he doesn't deal his 2 damage. And I would say, okay, you know, if that's how it goes, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in the end, we're not WizKids. We can't say for sure.
Yeah.
No, but it does seem to point to that. And while it's not intuitive, it does seem to be correct based on the rules as we have them at this point.
Yeah, I mean, based on rules as they're currently being interpreted, what's blocked has been blocked, even if it is no longer engaged. Because blocking and being engaged are 2 different things. And you can be blocked but not end the turn still engaged. And I think since we have those 2 words to describe these 2 different states, I do think there's enough to say that yes, that still does the damage because it's blocked and not KO'd, even if it's no longer engaged.
Spot on. Though I think at this point we have to throw up our own blocker and bring this episode of the reserve pool to the KO zone and perhaps move into prep, and we'll re-roll in another week's time. What do you guys say?
Yeah, yeah. Take 2 damage though, guys.
Yes, yes.
Sure, we don't want to put it to the use pile.
Well, we want to re-roll ourselves. We don't want to like have to go through the dice bag.
Yeah, that'd be less
nobody
cool.
Likes that.
Yeah, we want to make sure we're in the reserve pool as soon as possible.
All right, as always, thanks so much for listening, everybody, for spending a little bit of time with us. It does mean a lot to us. We'll see you again in 1 week's time. Please don't forget to interact with us in all of the myriad ways that you can. Otherwise, would you guys like to say your goodbyes?
Yeah, goodbye, guys. We'll see you next time.
Evan does not want to say goodbye, so I will.
No. Don't leave me, please.
Saying goodbye hurts.
No. Goodbye, everyone.
I will throw in my own goodbye. We'll see you again soon. Thanks so much.
Okay, today's fact talk is going to be about Avenging Angel.
Sorry. You said that. I'm sorry. The way you said that, I thought you... All right. Today's fact talk is brought to you by the letter E.
Yes, yes it is. Well, actually,
I'm
the letter A,
given
Avenging Angel.
That.
Angel.
That's good. That might be the outtake there. I'm so sorry.
Today's fact talk is brought to you by the letter Angel.
I'm so sorry.
Evan, it's...
Katie's also giggling
just
like
in
a
your
girl,
voice.
So it's not just
I
you.
Mean,
Evan has a pretty good announcer voice. He really does.
The way you said it, I was just ready for it to say by the letter, whatever. I apologize. Okay.
Actually, I do that for now.
On the side, I have been on Sesame Street.
I'm totally uncredited on Sesame Street.
I knew it. All right, I'm sorry. Go ahead and we'll start that back off. That's... Boy. Okay.
Can I say it like that again, though? That is how I'd like
no,
to
No, that's fine.
I
just will try
time.
Not to laugh.
I only laughed because Dave laughed. Whew.
Today's fact talk is about Avenging Angel, which sounds like you've got a bit of a... You're repetitive. If Angel is blocked, but not knocked out...
Stop it! Oh my god!
I'm sorry, it sounds a little bit like you're, You're repetitive. I'm sorry, Evan. I can't.
Evan, say angel avenging angel, angel.
I'm sorry. It was just... You're doing a fantastic job. It's just hilarious. That's all.
I actually know how I'm going to make fun of this now.
Please.
Go.